I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to this special Radio Times podcast. John Bogle, who founded the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, died yesterday at his home in Bryn Mawr, just outside of Philadelphia. He was 89 years old. He revolutionized investment and popularized the concept of low-cost indexing. He was a guest several times on Radio Times to talk about the greed he saw on Wall Street and how to help regular people invest their money. He was also an early whistleblower about the 2008 financial meltdown, and he helped me understand credit default swaps. We wanted you to hear an interview I did with John Bogle in 2012 to hear him describe his philosophy in his own words. You have been in this business for what, 61 years?
61 years.
What's the most dramatic change that you have observed from the beginning of your career to today?
I'd say it's this. I went to work in this business for Wellington Fund in 1951, right after I got out of college, and we had one fund. You kind of felt a duty and a loyalty to that fund, even a fiduciary duty as a kind of a trustee. Firms were small. Wellington Fund, while it was one of the larger firms in the business, had about $140 million of assets. And that was a culture, I think I could put it this way, that was a culture where we were in a profession with elements of a business. Over the years, this industry has changed radically. It's gone from maybe total assets of $2.5 billion back when I wrote my senior thesis about the fund industry at Princeton, from $2.5 billion to about $12 trillion. So it became a huge industry. It became a business with elements, and I would say far too few elements, of a profession. So now all of us, I mean, my firm runs about 160 funds. I'm not sure anybody knows exactly how many. And a firm like Fidelity, one of our rivals, runs 250 funds. So there's not that connection. It just, whether we like it or not, it goes away when you're trying to be responsible for 250 mutual funds.
Picking up on the subtitle of your book, Investment versus Speculation, what do you think was the sort of initial reason for this rise of speculation on Wall Street?
Well, I think it originally begins with two of the greatest bull markets in the history of the U.S. stock market. One was in the 80s, where there was a 17% annual return on stocks.
Unheard of,
except it was heard of again, remarkably, in the very next decade, in the 90s, another 17%. Largely because valuations of stocks, not the underlying intrinsic value of the stocks, the earnings and dividends, but the willingness of investors to pay extremely high prices for the stocks, from 10 times earnings to 20 times earnings to 40 times earnings, by just insane. And it couldn't continue, and of course it didn't. The return on stocks in the first decade of the 2000s was about minus 2%, one of the lowest, if not the lowest, total stock market return in history, decade-long return. So things come back. We have reversion to the mean. If you're way above the market, the level of value produced by business, you will come back to it. And so that's where we are now. I think the market is probably fairly valued. But that put an air of speculation in the air. We also had the development of the 401k thrift plan, corporate thrift plan, which is now, for better or for worse, I think probably for worse, pretty much replaced the corporate pension plan that was the known way to secure employees' retirement in the old days, is now sort of a vanishing part of the framework. There are fewer of them every year. And the dominant form, more money is invested in what we call defined contribution plans, like thrift plans, than is invested in defined benefit plans, like pension plans. So that gave investors a feeling that it was a nice game to play. They could play it tax-free. These 401ks are tax-free until you take money out of them and tax-deductible at the corporate level. So they're a pretty good deal, but you can't think you're smarter than the market. But people do. You play games and your money vanishes.
But are we also talking about the kind of short-term thinking that I think feeds speculation and also this level of what feels like mistrust of the system? The system is so complicated. Then you read about somebody in the newspaper and you see not just the complexity of it, but how people can game the system for their own benefit.
Yeah, well, what we have is it's really a peculiar thing. And we do an amazing amount of trading in stocks every year, an absurd amount, like 33 $1 trillion worth of trading each year. And what are we doing with that? We're trading. This should be obvious, but people seem to forget it. We're trading with each other. So when you buy a stock, you think you're smarter than the guy that you're going to buy it from. He may be unknown to you, but that's what happens in the market. And when you sell a stock, you think you're smarter than the buyer. But we're all, as a group, I mean, it's so simple. We're all average as a group. No Lake Wobegon here. So it's a culture of trading. It's a culture of kind of get rich quick. And it's partly the investor's fault. No question about that. We individual investors, you know, are trying to beat a system that in the long run we cannot beat. Mm. But any kind of behavior like that is grossly encouraged by the casinos of Wall Street, the traders, the brokers, the money managers. They're all appealing to the fact that you can do better than the market when only a minority of you can. On average, dare I repeat, we're all average.
Well, and you write about the amount of trading on the market that 99, I think I got this right, 99% of the stock market activity has to do with speculation, just exactly what you were talking about.
Well, yes, and as I think many of your listeners may know, the classic function of Wall Street, the financial system, was to direct new capital to the most promising business, capital formation, let's call it, to the business of most promise to create better products and services and to innovate and to become profitable companies. How much is that per year? Well, we know that because we know the amount of initial public offerings that come along each year, so-called IPOs, and we know the amount of secondary offerings, companies that not coming newly to the market but that need more equity capital. And that number turns out to be about $250 billion. Mm. So, yes, 0.8% of our financial system activity is directed to capital formation or investment, and 99.2%, I mean, it seems insane, but that's only because it is insane, directed toward speculation, trading with one another.
You also talk about the fact that it's ridiculous and probably wrong to keep watching the stock market every day, every hour, every second. You even say don't look for maybe a year or two or maybe even 5 years to see what your portfolio is doing, which seems unbelievable.
Or maybe even a lifetime.
How can you not peak?
I say, that's one of my rules is don't peak. But think about it this way. The stock market is an expensive way to participate in the ownership of American business. The stock market creates no value. The stock market subtracts because of the cost of the financial system, subtracts value from the returns earned by our corporate businesses. And those companies, our large companies, all American companies, mostly the heavily weighted with the largest ones, have around, let me say, $12 trillion worth of capital. Mm-hmm. And they earn money on that capital. That's what they're in business to do. They earn money. They pay, after they calculate their earnings, they pay you a dividend. And then whatever's left, they reinvest in the business so it'll grow even faster. This is the essence of a capitalistic system. It's competitive, reasonably competitive at least, and returns are generated by businesses. So you go into the stock market to buy those businesses. But in the stock market, you're trading them all the time. You're trading with one another. So the idea is to own the market and never trade and hold for what we call Warren Buffett's favorite holding period, hold your portfolio of the market forever.
Forever.
And the reason you don't peak is because you've taken an approach that says, you know, a lot of investments, a lot of your program, if you're speculating, you have to peak out all the time. But if you're just buying businesses, in the long run, businesses are profitable. They will grow along with the country. Not that the country's growth isn't a little bit fragile point right now, but it will grow at that rate anyway. And in the long run, you will capture the returns earned by business. And so when I say don't peak, what I'm saying is don't look at all. Wait until you retire 50 years later and open your statement, and I guarantee you, you will faint. There'll be so much money in your account, you'll wonder where it all came from.
But what do you do about something called high-frequency trading? And this is trading that happens in nanoseconds. I mean, this is the kind of speculation I think you're talking about.
This high-frequency trading, which is done accounts for now 40 or 50% of all trading in the stock market.
And it's button pushing,
right? Is button pushing. And part of it, you know, there is, we know in this life, the law of unexpected consequences. And by reducing commission fees so much, from maybe 25 cents when I came into this business, 25 cents a share, to maybe a penny a share or less. There's a whole business going on in trying to say, well, I'm going to buy this stock at $12.01, and I think I know someone that's going to come in and pay $12.02. Well, it doesn't sound like much, but if it's multiplied by 33 billion shares, there's a lot of money in it. It's computer-oriented. It has almost no human interface. So every once in a while, it runs wild in the market. Somebody pushes the wrong button, and the market, actually in what we call the flash crash a couple of years ago, the market basically stopped trading just because someone made a computer error. So it's very fragile, but people are creating a living for themselves, I think, with a lot of inside information, not about companies, like are they going to increase their dividend, for example, but about where the buying and selling are coming from. And if you know there's a big buyer out there, it's going to push the stock up a penny or 2 pennies, so you quickly jump in and then sell as soon as they buy. So it's not a good system.
You write about the failures, as you call them, of the gatekeepers. I'll list the gatekeepers here, members of Congress. You might throw the White House into that. Regulation in industries, the Federal Reserve, the SEC, the financial press, and the ratings agencies. All of those, in a sense, falling down on the job to manage and regulate Wall Street?
Yeah, they all let us down. But even worse, what we would expect to be the gatekeepers, corporate directors, good example. They're responsible for the management of the companies out there, whether it's General Electric or IBM or companies that are doing well or companies that are doing ill. And they did nothing. The corporations were inflating their earnings. They do what we call financial engineering. Mm-hmm. If we promised Wall Street 65 cents a share in the quarter, you're going to get the 65 cents a year come hell or high water. And that's why the accountants are involved. They let these companies basically meet their objectives. And so if nobody's going to watch, and then the security analysts, you know, they're often involved in these investment banking firms of doing new underwritings of securities. So they don't want to be known as someone who knocks stocks. It's a buying. They recommend buys, very rarely recommend sales. So it's a biased system. So there's a lot of blame to go around. Money managers, mutual fund managers, they share the blame. You know, they're doing all this trading. They're watching it go on. They're not complaining to management about inflating their earnings. They happen to like it. If the earnings are predictable, the money managers are very happy, even though the predictability is a forced and basically unrealistic thing.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. I want to find out if there are any good guys in this system. John Bogle is our guest today on Radio Times, and he has just written his 10th book. It's called The Clash of Cultures, Investment versus Speculation, and he has spent 61 years in this business of investment, and he's the current president of the Vanguard Group's Bogle Financial Markets Research Center, founder of the Vanguard Group back in 1974. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with John Bogle about his thoughts about our financial, regulatory, and political systems. He's written his 10th book, and it's titled The Clash of Cultures, Investment versus Speculation. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I guess it was about 4 years ago we were on that precipice. The Wall Street was collapsing. Yep. The political system was in shambles, clearly. Do you see any bright spots in the last 4 years in terms of our financial investment system?
Well, there has been a lot of retrenchment. A lot of investors, individual homeowners, for example, paid a big price. But there's much less borrowing net in our consumer system. Corporations' balance sheets are in much better shape, probably better shape than ever been in history.
Really?
And the federal government is working toward some kind of way to reduce the deficits we'll face in the next few years, which I think up to a point is a good idea. I hope we don't go too far, because this is an economy that still needs help, still needs government stimulus. And I happen to still be a believer in the man I studied at Princeton back in the 1940s and 50s, late 40s and early 50s, John Maynard Keynes. And he's kind of anathema to the free market people, but I think it works. Witness the fact that the stimulation we've done has given us pretty close to the greatest economic recovery from those unpleasant times of any country in the developed world. You know, Britain is not doing well. Germany may be doing better, but Britain is not doing well. France is not doing well. Italy is not doing well. All our kind of peer developed nations who have generally got to, and Greece to say the least, have done austerity rather than stimulation. And that's partly a problem of the euro uniting all those countries from a fiscal standpoint, from a monetary standpoint, I should say. And so we're doing better than most, and I think that's all we could hope for.
But do you think more people or people should have gone to prison for what had happened with our financial system? Were laws broken? Were crimes committed?
Unequivocally, yes. I've described the system as one that has too much crime and not enough punishment. And the problem seems to be that it's fairly easy to settle cases with corporations. Corporations pay the government for their misdeeds, and nobody gets accused. No individual gets accused, and almost no. A few people have gone to jail. Madoff has gone to jail, and Dennis Kozlowski at one of the giant corporations has gone to jail, and actually a number of others. But the problem with this is in the legal system and the way Wall Street is developed, we have to prove, the government has to prove, and up to a point this is right and good and consistent with our Constitution, but you have to prove some kind of criminal intent. Right. And it's really difficult to prove. I mean, how do you say? I mean, it may be obvious to you that there was an intent to deceive or intent to defraud, but it's very difficult to prove before a jury. And some of these cases that I would have said were egregious are juries. The jury of our peers has let the person go free. And so it's the legal system, I think we can do a better job of restructuring, although it's still under great challenge as to whether, you know, the SEC, bless them, and the Justice Department have been able to tape phone calls with very important people in the American financial system, basically calling up their associates with hedge funds, something like that, and saying, here's something's going to happen.
Right.
And you don't even have to say you better buy. The person at the other end of the phone knows you have to buy.
That's the kind of insider trading you were talking
about. Yeah, kind of
information.
Insider information. And they're arguing, their lawyers are arguing, that they didn't have the right to wiretap. Well, the wiretap is, I think, one of the great advantages, great assets of securities regulation from now on. So if the courts throw that out, and the courts have done, in my opinion, some mighty stupid things, if I may say so, with fervor, in our time, but I don't think they'll be able to get away with that one.
But you think there's too close a relationship between our political system and our financial system?
Well, there is. I mean, the bankers and the investment bankers, and they're hard to tell apart now because they're too all mixed, and have so much money. They do all this lobbying. You think about the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act of a couple of years ago intended to respond to all this, and it's, I don't know, 1,000 pages long or something. And they're calling for 198, I believe the number is, different regulations. And some of those have hundreds of pages. Right. And the bankers and their lobbyists basically fight every comma. And sometimes they're successful, sometimes less. But here, I think 3 years after the law was passed, I'm not sure any regulations have come out, have gone through that maze. So, you know, the regulators got outgunned. The people inside the system obviously know much more than people about outside the system than how it works. So it's going to be a lot to change this culture.
Are there any good guys, good gals in the system that we have created?
Well, in a way, I'll give you a few names, but in a way it's kind of sad because the most respected names in finance are Paul Volcker and John Whitehead, former head of Goldman Sachs, and Bill Donaldson, who's been the head of the stock exchange and the head of the SEC both, as well as being an entrepreneur. And they're really the big names in the system. And with one exception, they're older than I am. And, you know, I don't know where the new energy from the younger people in this business is going to come from because you get wrapped up in the business side rather than the crusading side. I think Warren Buffett is doing a really good job, always has and always will. He's a pillar of integrity that seems to be able to stand up for what's right. And in the fund business, the firms I like are the firms that haven't gotten to become marketing companies. Mm. They're still management companies. And they're going to have their ups and downs. Everybody that runs mutual funds in this business has good years and bad years, good eras and bad years. But if you're going to go into an actively managed fund, these kind of firms that have maybe run a half a dozen firms rather than 250 are the firms to go with.
I thought it was interesting that you said, and you also write about in your book, criticizing, I believe criticizing is the right word, the 401k retirement program and moving away from the defined benefit pension program. But many companies, many organizations are doing this.
Yes.
They can't afford the defined benefit pension.
That's right. They don't want to take they want to transfer the risk of retirement savings from themselves to the employees.
Exactly.
And that would be fine if the employees were capable of dealing with it. But most are not. And they are, I think, victimized is the right word, by having the companies offer either too many funds. You know, there's such a thing as too many choices in this world, and too many funds, and often funds that are too expensive, and funds that are doing much more speculative than speculation than investment. And if you look at the favored funds, we know all these things in this great information age. The leading mutual fund holdings of the 401k plan, well, 10 years ago it was the Magellan Fund. It had a remarkably successful record, unbelievably successful, and actually a little bit phony, if I may say so, in the early years. But by the time everybody got interested in it and buying it, it changed the industry in a lot of ways. Everybody had to make room for Magellan in their plan, whether it was a Fidelity fund or whether it was not. And, of course, as soon as that happens, it stops, and the performance has been, you know, at very, very best, mediocre. For now, that would be 20 years, almost 20 years, not since 1992 or 3. So we pick backward. We pick based on past performance, and that just can't and doesn't continue. So when you have expensive choices, when you make bad investment decisions, when you're allowed to take your money out of the plan whenever you want or whenever you can borrow from it, and when you change jobs, you get it, and you can just spend it at that point, and a lot of people do. So it's a system. Imagine what the Social Security system would look like if you were able to take money out every time your wife needed a new kitchen or a new living room rug. You would have no, quote, Social Security, quote, when you retired. So the system itself has to be strengthened and make it much more difficult to get out of the system.
I was reading that 70% of, I guess, retired Americans, or perhaps soon to be retiring Americans, are going to rely solely on their Social Security. That they don't, even if they were to invest and maybe make a little bit of money or maybe lose some of that money, many people don't even have that.
Well, that's, of course, true in our society. And, you know, something like, I don't mean to be unkind or anything, but something like 40% of our citizens simply aren't able. They aren't making enough money. You know, if you're selling hamburgers at McDonald's, you're going to have a hard time putting a lot away for savings. And so you're going to have to rely on Social Security. And that should give you a base. And maybe, as in the old days, old days, a family will have to help a little bit. And the government may have an additional role to play. But so the number is not really quite 70% if you take out those that are simply, it's not financially practicable in any way, shape, or form. But it's going to be tough for people that are well-to-do to rely essentially on Social Security. But, you know, you could argue it's their own fault for not saving more and not investing more intelligently. But the reality is that the financial system capitalizes on our human behavioral weaknesses and makes a lot of money doing it.
The fact that we are impulsive, we don't necessarily know what we're doing. We invest in things that are going down as opposed to things that are going up.
Well, what we do when we buy a mutual fund is we look at past performance.
Right.
And, you know, the index fund, I think you mentioned, which I started, and it's now 30% of the fund business, been hugely in demand, particularly in recent years. But the financial community doesn't like index funds. They call them Bogle's folly. Right. They call them un-American. They call me a communist. And which is all kind of fun now, is they stamp out index funds. The government had a little stamp that got rid of them all in one famous poster of the day. But a broker can always say, yeah, that's not so good because I have this fund that beat it. And, of course, there's always somebody that's going to beat it, and somebody's going to beat it by quite a bit over whatever time period your financial advisor is going to show you. And you think that's going to continue. He knows it's not going to continue. He knows. And you should know. We have a lot in the book about reversion to the mean, about funds that do very well for a time, then do badly. Universally, this is not a spot example. Every fund that has ever done extremely well followed it by years and years of doing extremely badly.
And that's just a fact. And that's John Bogle, our guest today on Radio Times. Let me get some callers in on our conversation. We are talking about his new book and talking about some themes that have been, I think, very much a part of his career. The book is called The Clash of the Cultures, Investment versus Speculation. And we have a full bank of calls. Let's see what Carol from Mount Airy has to say. Carol, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
This question for an explanation is from my very limited understanding. I would like to know why it seems that speculators don't seem to have a downside. I was reading something about the Chicago Board of Trades, and the way I saw it, speculators brought buyers and sellers together and provided a market service for farmers. Mm-hmm. And they could experience the same gains and losses and exposure. And then something changed, and now they have no sense of moral hazard to restrain them. Is it the regulations? What happened? It seems like there was a time when speculator wasn't a four-letter word.
Well, Carol, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, John Bogle.
Yeah, let me just say this. There's one thing that is eternal about the financial system, and that is we're all average, and the winners on a speculative bet, there are losers on the other side by the exact same amount, except deducting Wall Street's cost. That has never changed, even today's really speculative times. What makes today's times more speculative is there's more trading. You know, mutual fund portfolio turnover when I came into this business was about 25%, meaning the average fund held the average stock for about 4 years. Actually, it was more like 16%. The average holding period was about 6 years. Today, the average mutual fund turnover is 100%. Mm. So the average holding period is 1 year. And, you know, that's very close to rank speculation. And at least when it was 6 years, there was a hint of long-term focus. So it's changed. The culture has changed. In part because people are looking for short-term results, and you can affect them a lot if you speculate in the short term, you depart from the market. But for every winner, there is a loser, and that is eternal.
Carol, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I mentioned this earlier, but I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying, because I also wonder about even the impact of the financial crisis of 4 years ago, the sense that that people don't trust each other. And if you don't trust each other, then you can't think long term, because you want to get in and get out and get your money and move on, rather than thinking this is going to be here for a while. Our system works. The future looks brighter, and that seems to me that inspires long-term thinking.
Well, it should be exactly that way, and people will learn from their own experience. I mean, what's happening in the mutual fund industry is a very good example of this. Right today, and in the last 5 years, investors have withdrawn about $400 billion from actively managed mutual funds. These are firms that say we can manage your money effectively, and investors saying, in effect, they're voting with their feet, oh, no, you can't. $600 billion has gone into index funds, where the manager says, we will give you your fair share of whatever returns the stock market is kind enough to give us, or for that matter, mean enough to take away from us. Mm. So we've had a big example of long-term investment replacing speculation in the fund. That's $600 billion in and $400 billion out of actively managed funds into index funds and out of actively managed is a $1 trillion swing in investor preferences. So people are getting the word, and it's growing every day.
Let me see what Wendell from Kennett Square has to say. Wendell, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Right. Well, I have the greatest respect for Mr. Bogle. As you usually say about people like him, another person is Martin Wolf, who's a columnist for the Financial Times, is that were he to run for world dictator, I'd probably vote for him.
We don't vote for dictators in this, right.
Yeah, and I wouldn't vote for me, but you're very kind.
Go ahead, Wendell.
I'm sure that's what Martin Wolf or somebody else would say. But anyway, what Mr. Mr. Vogel says, and he's obviously a very experienced, knowledgeable person, intelligent, decent, is he aware whether anyone in a policy-setting position in anywhere in Washington, Congress, or in an administration or whatever, actually listens to him? Does he talk to people directly? Does he have any sense whether people listen to what he has to say, or is he more or less ignored as far as he knows?
Wendell, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
That's really a good question, and I have had my experiences. I've testified at Congress. I've testified at the Senate. And I found Senator Peter Fitzgerald, former senator from Illinois, was one of them. And they get it. They like working with me. We talk to each other as kind of one-on-one. I've testified before him. And he thinks my philosophy is just as good as you seem to think it is. So, and I've also worked, I don't do any mass stuff. I don't go down to Congress and demand to hear this and that. But if I'm invited, I go. I also want to add this, that I've usually stayed fairly close to either the head of investment management or the head of investment management at the SEC and to the chairman of the commission itself. And I just want to say I'm glad to have an opportunity to say this, that Mary Shapiro, the outgoing chairman, has done a super job in trying to pull all this mess together with limited staff, and she's harassed by the Congress. There's a district judge down in Washington that is overturned for inane reasons, and many of the SEC's rulings, their findings make no sense at all. And I think out of frustration, she left the SEC. I believe her position on money market funds, floating net asset value and so on, was correct. She's outspoken. She's smart. And I think she would be one of the better public servants I've met in my long career.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with John Bogle, author of a new book, his 10th. It's called The Clash of the Cultures, Investment versus Speculation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with John Bogle. He's the founder of the Vanguard Group, now the country's largest mutual fund. He's currently the president of the Vanguard Group's Bogle Financial Markets Research Center. And again, as I have said several times during this hour, he's written his 10th book called The Clash of the Cultures, Investment versus Speculation. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John Bogle, we got something on our Facebook page yesterday. We did a program about the horrible shootings in Newtown, Connecticut. And this listener wanted to know about ethical investing, saying as Vanguard is the largest single shareholder in Smith & Wesson Holding Corporation, she goes on to say, being a parent of two elementary school children and a holder of several Vanguard accounts, one via my kids, 529, makes my current investing decisions more complex. And I think it's ethical investing is always an important thing to think about.
It's a very important thing to think about, and I don't think any of us, including yours truly, do nearly a good enough job on it. But let me just say a word about Smith & Wesson and Vanguard's holdings, I don't know, or Vanguard funds. And that is, we are probably the largest, almost certainly the largest single, because we're the largest mutual fund company, we're the largest holder. We probably own 5% of just about every corporation in America. The reason we do is because our strategy is one of indexing, hold the market. If Smith & Wesson is in the market, Smith & Wesson, then we will be holding that. And so should we speak up? The answer is yes. Should we get out of the stock? I think that's pretty debatable, because if your whole strategy is hold the whole market, you end up making a whole lot of judgments that are never quite as clear as one might hope. Mm. And so it's something we ought to be thinking about and maybe sometime doing something. But we couldn't have, for example, go to Smith & Wesson Management and say, get out of the gun business. That's their business. And the other thing that's very important to think about here is if we got out of that stock, the company wouldn't even know it. Somebody else would own it. And so you don't have the kind of clout that you would think that a 5% or so owner of the stock would have.
Because you would think you would have that kind of clout, at least to be able to sit at the table to talk about, in this case, I guess, reasonable gun control.
Yeah, and the problem with ethical investing, I think, is well summed up, Marty, by a letter I got some years ago when tobacco stocks were the issue. And, of course, they are in the index funds because they're in the index. And She said she was going to leave our fund called Windsor Fund and go to a social responsibility fund. So I got the Ethical Responsibility Fund. So I got out their annual report and took a look at what they thought was ethical investing, and their largest holding was in Caesar's World, the gambling company. So, you know, it's a judgmental thing. It's a little hard to say that there is no useful. I mean, we have defense contractors, for example, that are using the weapons. I don't know about the Smith case, but how much of them are using by the Department of Defense. So it's complicated, and one is horrified in retrospect at looking at that participation, if you will, in arms, you know, manufacturing of arms, even sidearms, and yet doesn't quite engage in the struggle to figure out, is there a better way to think about all these things? So I confess to having some doubts. I'm sort of a doubting Thomas here.
Well, and I should say to our listeners, we were talking before going on the air, and you said two issues that got almost no discussion during the presidential race had to do with guns and had to do with climate change. And you seeing these as two important bookends that we need to deal with.
Well, yeah, I've said to friends and associates and my family, one of the horrifying things about today's financial system is in the recent campaign, we totally ignored the most important short-term – this is long before the events in Connecticut – the most important short-term problem facing America, which I believe is some kind of reasonable arms control, for the want of a better expression, and the most important long-term issue facing our nation, which is, of course, climate change. And they don't come up as political issues because they're too hot, no pun intended, in either case, too hot to handle.
Let me get Reggie from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Reggie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have Reggie? We don't seem to have Reggie. Let me ask you, because I began the show with this press conference that was held by a United for Fair Economy's Responsible Wealth Project. You have added your name to the list of other wealthy Americans who say it's time to think about a higher estate tax. Why do you think that's important?
Well, it's important for what I believe is the simplest reason in the world. And that is, you know, we who have been extremely lucky in life and financially favored, if we aren't going to pay our fair share of taxes, including an inheritance tax, then somebody else is going to have to pay it. And by definition, those taxes will be paid by those less able to afford it. So what are we thinking when we fight that? I mean, it seems to me to be a socially appropriate, financially appropriate. And, you know, we grow up in this system with all the advantages of being American citizens in a society with American institutions, with shareholder protections, with a legal system, with, generally speaking, safe streets to walk on. And if we don't take responsibility, we who are, you know, most of these people are a little more, you know, like the billionaires and so on. I'm not any
You're not a billionaire.
Miles, not anywhere near, which is fine with me. But I'd like to pay my fair share. And I know Warren Buffett wants to pay his fair share. So do it. Let's just do it.
Mm. But are you also saying that you did well and others have done well because of our government, because of the other people in this country who have helped to create this country and our systems?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the right of American citizenship, that one simple thing, is priceless. I mean, when I had a friend a few years ago who said he was very proud that he was entirely a self-made man. I did it all myself. That's what I'm really proud of. And I couldn't stand it. So I said to him, I think that's wonderful. How on earth did you arrange to be born in the United States of America? He didn't seem to have a particularly good answer for that.
And did he build our roads by himself?
Yeah, exactly. We do nothing by ourselves. Obama is certainly right on that one.
Let me see what Joe from Macungie has to say. Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Oh, interesting. Sounds like we have some phone problems. We will try another caller as well. Let me ask you about how you think income should be treated. And certainly people that are living off investments, maybe paying, as it stands now, I think 15% of their income in taxes. People that have regular jobs paying more than that, certainly if they're making more money. Do you think all income should be treated equally?
At the minimum.
At the minimum.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me the base rate, and this is the way our tax system was from the time I first knew it existed, probably since I was working for a living in the summers. First time I was conscious of the amount taxes took was probably 1940 or something. But that the lowest rate should be paid by those who are working for a living, who are earning their living by the sweat of their brow or the furrows of the brain or however you want to put it. In those days and up until, you know, the Reagan era or just before the Reagan era, the taxes on unearned income, so-called dividends and capital gains were much higher. I think that was appropriate. And then we went to give a break to capital gains and to dividends. And then President Reagan made them all the same. But I think when you get to a certain level, there ought to be a premium paid for those who are earning dividend income and those that are earning capital gain income, which looked at from my vantage point is gambling income. You make money by trading, outsmarting somebody else. It's like going to Las Vegas, except the Las Vegas croupier probably takes less money out of your account than the Wall Street croupier does, or the state lottery for that matter. And so I would have my ideal system would be to have a flat rate on income, maybe two or three flat rates growing up, very simple tax system, with the base rate being for individuals who earned income, and then probably an exemption for average income for maybe the first $25,000 of income and capital gains. So those families that are saving retirement won't be taxed on that saving. Right now it's all exempt for those individuals. So give them a limit and then have a capital gains tax, premium tax, on short-term capital gains, certainly on short-term capital gains, and maybe even a small premium on long-term capital gains. And if someone can figure out a way to do it, I would differentiate capital gains by those who earn businesses by providing better goods and better services and better products at lower and lower cost more efficiently to American consumers, and then as compared to those who make the money gambling.
Let's see what Adam from New Jersey has to say. I'm crossing my fingers here, hoping we can get him on the air. Adam, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks. Hi. I read something online recently. It was about having a transaction tax on the stock market, you know, like a small percentage that would provide a disincentive for speculators and provide an incentive for people to hold stocks, you know, over a longer period of time. And I was just wondering if you had a comment on that.
Adam, thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead, John.
Yeah, I do think a transaction cost, very modest, that would slow down this high-frequency trading, which creates no value except for the high-frequency trading firms themselves, because buyers and sellers, again, offset. And I think that's a good idea. I also think we have another mysterious thing going on that has to be fixed, and that is capital gains, particularly short-term capital gains, earned by existing tax-exempt financial institutions, call it corporate pension funds, state and local government pension funds, thrift plans run by mutual funds. There should be a tax on short-term capital gains realized by those heretofore totally tax-exempt institutions. The tax exemption basically allows you to trade to your heart's content without any loss.
Adam, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what John from West Grove has to say. And, John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, you make a lot of sense, obviously. I've been in and around corporate America for, 45 years or so. And one of the things that seems to me is happening, I wonder if it is a result of all this speculative trading and emphasis on stock price, is this total focus on short-term shareholder value in companies. And if that doesn't lead to a lot shorter-term thinking instead of long-term planning and development in companies.
John?
I agree with you totally.
Go ahead, John Bogle. Yes.
But I do want to maybe split a hair with you a little bit. The focus is on creating short-term improvement in stock price. Get the stock price of the stock, which is basically trying to inflate investor expectations to get the price up, which, you know, you can't do it unless you finally deliver with real returns. The way to create value as distinct from price is to reinvest money in the business, to increase cash flow, to take on organizational efficiencies, to have a satisfied workforce. I mean, all these things create corporate value. To have a sense of values in the corporation, social values for that matter, to run the corporation responsibly. Those things are the long-term drivers of corporate value. You've got to be good at introducing new products, of staying competitive, of improving prices and efficiencies and product quality. And that's the way to build corporate value, which is separate from stock price increases, which will come with corporate value in the long run, but not in the short run.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. One of the phrases that came out of actually was the Republican primary, but it's been picked up by others, is the phrase vulture capitalism. Does that resonate with you, the idea of vulture capitalism?
Yeah, and I'm not so happy about it. And vulture capitalism is people that go around buying what they think are undervalued companies. And that, up to that point, I think is fine. But what happens is they take these companies and they borrow a lot of money to take them over. So they've got a huge amount of debt, a lot of leverage. And then they have been known, and this is where the vulturism, if you want to call it that, comes in. Then they pay themselves a big dividend, and the people that own the stock don't get the dividend. Your partners in the vulture company or the equity capital company or whatever you call private equity company. It's not an even game. Companies go out of business. Long-term people who created the value for that company, lifetime employees who have given their lives to the company, find themselves out of work and in this day and age very difficult to get reemployed. So it comes at a terrible social cost. I want to underscore that I do believe that some of this capitalism that drives price, that finds companies that have been undermanaged or that have been badly managed, someone ought to have an ability to go to the marketplace and say they can do it better, but they don't do it in a way that I find particularly satisfying, or at least there are too many cases where they don't do it in a way that I think is appropriate, given the nature of our society and given the reality. You know, these companies eventually go out of business, and a lot of perfectly good people and a lot of perfectly good communities are in fact ruined, and I don't think that helps our society.
You grew up during the Depression. What kind of impact do you think that has had on you?
Well, it certainly made me a cheapskate.
And you are, right?
Yeah,
well known.
I don't like to spend money. From the very beginning, I've thought the world is essentially fair. If you want to buy something, save up and buy it. It may take you 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, but you finally get your nice bike. So I was a little saved my money and had, you know, a nice bike and some other things, but it just gave me a distaste for conspicuous consumption. I have all I could possibly want. My wife has all she could possibly want, and my family will eventually have a nice – I mean, they're doing fine now, but they will be, you know, a little better off after I'm going to my reward. But that's enough. I mean, I have a foundation and a whole lot of charities that will participate in my estate when I'm gone, and so I'm happy to, you know, basically in another way pay my debt, as we talked about a little bit, and to the society that made me what I am, really.
Well, on that note, John Bogle, it's always a great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times, and I thank you very much.
Fun to be with you, Marty.
You're welcome. And his book, John Bogle's book, is called The Clash of the Cultures, Investment versus Speculation. And you can go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. In fact, if you go to our Facebook page, there's some photos of John Bogle there that you can look at. He's currently the president of the Vanguard Group's Bogle Financial Markets Research Center, founder of the Vanguard Group back in 1974. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.